Jenny. Welcome to the 8th episode of the Reading Envy podcast, where we'll have what you're reading. Actually, today, we is more like I. I've gone rogue. Scott is off-site working this month. I'm going to be away next month. So I took the opportunity to talk to a few of the people that I talk about books with all the time and get them on the podcast. By day, I'm an academic librarian. And before you start making assumptions, I want to say that librarians do not sit and read all day long. That's probably one of the worst misconceptions people have about us. I often get that response from people. Oh, it must be nice to be a librarian. I would love to read books all day long. Oh, so would I. And if you know that magical job that pays you enough money to live on, let me know. I could talk for hours about what it is we actually do, but I'd rather talk about books. So I've asked three of the people that I talk about books with all the time because they work in the same building as me to come on the podcast today. You'll hear from Steve, and then from Libby, and then from Mike. And if there's time at the end, I might tell you a little bit about what I've been reading lately too. Welcome, Steve.
Thank you so much. It's great to have this opportunity. I love it. I'm Steve Richardson. I've been at Furman a long time. This is my 28th year. I'm a Furman graduate. And I'm also a native of Greenville County, in which Furman is located. So I've been around a while. A good bit of my family's gone to Furman. But I've been here at the library for a good bit.
That's amazing. Mm-hmm. And what kind of books do you like to read?
They're really varied, which I'm really glad of. Until recent years, I really was... sort of chastised myself for not getting into fiction more than I had, which was really the reason I enjoyed reading in the first place. And but after so many years of it and having to respond to it, I guess, in college, I ventured out into other places. I got very interested in history of all kinds. I mean, I'm very interested in the history of the South and American history, but also European history and Middle Europa I like a lot, and the Mediterranean, Renaissance period. So I eventually began reading much more in the way of history and nonfiction narrative, although I tried to make it selective in terms of what type of writers they were. So I took recommendations from different places, and mostly it was by way of the bibliographies. I looked at the footnotes and then saw how often someone showed up with something I thought was, they really made a difference in what this person was trying to deliver, and I probably should look at what they were saying too. So the bibliographic chain is what set me off too in that course, and for several years I just went from one chain to the next, and before I knew it, I was immersed in nonfiction. I didn't leave fiction totally behind, but it wasn't something that I was enjoying like I remembered having done so. So I took some recommendations, and now I read just about everything. I'll make myself read fiction. I now don't have to make myself, but I'll read fiction as often as I do nonfiction, and I always read several at one time, which probably isn't good, especially not now that I'm getting a little older and keeping the narrative straight and the characters straight and all the rest of it. But I generally have 3 to 4 fiction, 3 to 4 nonfiction kind of going at the same time,
you know? Wow.
Which is one reason why I can't get into ebooks too much, because you can't keep them that long. I can't read a book, and I'm not that fast a reader either, so that's not going to change, I don't think.
So then how do you pick which of the 4 to 8 to read? Do you pick by mood?
That's a good question. I think mood does have something to do with it. Mm-hmm. And of course, what I had read previously. And I do read a good many journal articles, blogs occasionally. And so I visit this site called Arts and Letters Daily that you might be familiar with. And they do a great job of selecting articles. They do it about 2 or 3 times a week, I think, and so they change 2 or 3 times a week, and they come from reviews. You'll get some book reviews, and you'll get some that are just essays or blogs, and it's they're always, I find, to be pretty high quality. And I'll get recommendations from there, and I'll see something that, oh, yeah, I remember reading about that individual or what that book was about, and I just years ago had let it slide, had not gotten back to it. And that'll make me do that as well. And then often, just like in the book I was going to talk about today, one of the ones, I already have five books that he suggested from that book. And those kind of things happen. You know,
so you'll never run out of things.
No, you'll just never run out. Thank goodness.
That means we live forever, I think.
I think so. Yeah, that's a great way of looking at it.
Well, I hadn't heard of Arts and Letters Daily, but I wrote it down because it sounds like something I should be keeping track of.
There's a link on the Chronicle site, I think. They at least advertise on Arts and Letters Daily's site. But, I recommend it. It'd be something fun to look at anyway.
Yeah, sounds good. So what book did you bring or books did you bring to talk about?
I brought one. I've read just recently these two books by a British teenager. He made the trip when he was a teenager. He was 19 years old. His name is Patrick Lee Fermor. And he led kind of an erratic youth. And his mother and sister moved to India, and he was left with some people in England, and went through several schools and was always a problem student, and discipline-wise and otherwise. And he ended up in Cambridge. I forget which college at Cambridge it was, actually. But he didn't last very long. And it mainly had to do with disciplinary problems. But he had such a sharp mind that he picked up on things so quickly, especially language. He was very astute and interested in how language is developed. But what exactly made him take the plunge for this trip, he doesn't really get around to saying, except that he had to get out of England. And so at 19, what he decides to do is to walk, is what his aspiration is to actually walk on foot from the Hook of Holland to Constantinople.
Wow.
Which it's quite ambitious, but And the name of the first, there's three legs to the journey that are in book form. One has just been published last year, called The Broken Road. But the ones I was going to mention were, the first one is called A Time of Gifts, and it takes him from the Hook of Holland, actually from the Thames, when he gets on board a small ship there, across to Rotterdam. And takes him from there through the heart of Germany and or through Holland, heart of Germany, and into every different province that he is so specific about naming, whether it had been Hungary at one time, or if it had been Moldavia, or if it had been part of Serbia or Croatia or whatever, and who may have been the leading ethnic group there. He makes such a study out of what has been historically in a particular location. But anyway, this first one takes him from the Hook of Holland to the Danube River, the middle of the Danube, when he first crosses the Danube at a place called Esztergom, which was the capital of Hungary for a good long while, for about 250 years, something like that. That's where the emperors were crowned, and so he makes a big deal out of that. And I find that what he expresses in his journey, and he's taken this from a diary that he wrote on the way, as well as letters that he sent to his mother. And he doesn't write this until 40-something years later. Wow. 1977 is when he writes this. And not only does he have a terrific style of writing and voluminous vocabulary and endless depth of historical knowledge, but he also has a great imagination, and he certainly embellishes some things, which makes the narrative good. But he had to He had a prodigious memory. He remembered locations that just triggered things, and almost Proust-like, you know, he would think of seeing someone on a particular road, these peasants, and then maybe some gypsies that followed him, and he creates this mise en scène, you know, this just goes on for a couple of miles and describes everything that they do, what they're wearing, what conversation they tried to have. He would try German, then he tried a little Hungarian, and then he was getting a little bit better with some of it, and then he really got in trouble trying to master Romanian. It was just the kind of thing that he did not expect them to have, the kind of Latinness that it had as compared to Hungary, and they, because it was one of the last places that Rome evacuated. And they kept a lot of their Latin constructions that didn't seem to make sense to him because they didn't sound like them, but that's where they came from. But he describes cathedrals. He has the ability, even though he was going to walk, and he really wanted to rough it. So he'll look for a stable or something like that, or a wagon to sleep up under. And he just has a knapsack. But he does have a cane that... And during that time, if you went from town to town, they would stamp a metal ornament on your cane for that particular town. And he had his cane almost completely metallized by the time he got to just before he got to the Danube, and then he lost it. He left it someplace in a shed or something like that when he was hurrying to get away. But the people he meets on the way are just fascinating, and they range from peasants and gypsies and he calls gypsies various things both in one country and another, and it's kind of hard to keep it. He calls them Romani in some places and gypsies other, all the way up to counts, because he has these people that call ahead for him, and they'll call the mayor of the city, and they'll arrange for him to stay in a castle or schloss, you know, as they would call it there, or castellet. And it's just incredible. He describes all the libraries that these people have, and how he gets involved with the books, how they got there, and gets in discussion with them, sometimes in German, sometimes broken English, sometimes Austrian and Slavic. So he tries a little bit of everything to get along. He's just a remarkable character, and the way he describes those visits that are both in the lap of luxury, and I mean ancient luxury too. These incredible castles inside and out with decorations that go back centuries, and into the villages where he first, it seems, is very keen on describing the cathedrals that he sees, and he's. The other thing about that is sort of married to that, I think, is his fascination with ritual. And so often, and it makes you wonder, how many rituals could you come across, you know? But, I mean, feast days and that sort of thing, that he and market days. So everything to him is a ritual. And the scene that he paints is seems to be so faceted in so many ways, but he really delves into the ritual as to why these people, even though they're not Catholic, but they've held on to their Orthodox roots, but they're doing Catholic things, and they mix their rituals back and forth, and he's fascinated with it. He tries to explain that, you know, and goes back into the history of why these people were kind of under the thumb of certain political situations that made it beneficial for them to act Catholic, even if they weren't. But all of them are somewhat different. So he's fascinated with rituals of all kinds, and their origins and evolution in a particular location and in and among the different ethnic groups, and why they continue to do what they do, and who it is they venerate in a certain place, and just a little bit down the road, with no obvious change whatsoever, they have totally different veneration for people, and they may change almost diametrically opposed, but they don't have a political problem with each other. And it sounds almost like an idyllic situation when you think about things now that that happen with between ethnicities so closely arrayed like that. But there was a lot going on then too. He just happened to be there at a time when it should have been a problem, but they didn't know it then, because this was just when Hitler came to power in 1933-34. And it's interesting how he describes seeing the swastika at different places and how he can identify a Nazi from any distance, but at the same time, or identify someone, I bet they're a good Nazi, you know, or something like that. But he at that time doesn't have any kind of political allegiance whatsoever as far as to whether this right wing or this left wing is good, bad, or indifferent. It's just what they do.
Doesn't necessarily feel the war coming.
No, he doesn't.
That's interesting, because I just recently read George Orwell's diaries.
Oh.
From 1929 to 49-ish, right before he died. And he knew. I mean, he knew something big was coming. So it's interesting that they could both be journaling at the same time, and one person could tell. Yeah.
Was he in the countries then? Was he in Europe when he was journaling?
He was in England. But he read like 5 different newspapers every day.
Yeah.
So he really paid attention and was annoyed that people around him hadn't. So a little bit different
isn't
experience.
That interesting? Yeah. I think he was Fermor, that is. I mean, he was a good bit self-indulgent, and but at the same time, it's like the fellow who writes the introduction to the book says that writing writers are, how has it said, something like, let me get this real quick, because it says, envy is the writer's sin, as everyone knows, but there can be few writers in the English-speaking world who resent Patrick Leigh Fermor's preeminence as one of the great prose stylists of our time. He has no rivals, and so stands beyond envy. So there are a lot of people who cut him down for what he was writing, and for good reason, because I'm sure he elaborated some, you know, and he was writing this 40 years memory.
Right.
But he also had a lot of notes and a lot of journals, too. So, and, you know, I think Somerset Maugham said something about him being a middle-class gigolo who just paid attention to the upper class, you know, or something like that. Mm-hmm. Well, that's envy, you know, I think more than anything else.
And he was so young.
So, anyway, that it's the second, this one is, as I said, a time of gifts. The second one is Between the Woods and the Water, that carries him from the Danube into Bulgaria, into Romania and Bulgaria. I understand that the Broken Road does actually get him to the Black Sea and then down to Pontus there and into Constantinople, or at least close. But he reminds himself throughout the two that I've read that he feels as if he's never going to get there, because he keeps making these side trips, because he runs into people who are willing to take, you can't come this far without seeing Prague. You know, so they put him on a train, and I mean, he has such luck with and good fortune with meeting these people who are willing to ingratiate themselves, you know, they just put him up for as long as he'd like, and he starts feeling guilty about the fact that he's not roughing it anymore. So when he left Hungary, he decided he was going to change that. So for 3 or 4 nights, and plus the fact too, it was spring and summer by that time. Mm-hmm. I can't imagine when he was roughing it some. He was doing it in winter. I mean, deadly cold stuff. I mean, it was how in the world he, you know, managed that. And he didn't, it wasn't that much in terms of cover that he had, but. But yeah, he roughed it for a little while after that. But then, when he had a chance, he would he might take a ride in a cart, you know, and occasionally a car that would come by. But he would start feeling guilty, and he'd then he'd lay up and sleep under a tree or sleep with some band of Romani or gypsies, and which was great because the way he described them was and what they did and what they how they ate, how they prepared their food, what they sang, what they and the music that they played was these glissandos, he says, you know, that ripple across these zither strings and flutes and everything. And just he just has wonderful wording about whether it's a ritual or singing or a library or what it might be. So
this third one that just came out, I imagine he's not the person that pulled it together. Someone else?
No, yeah, it was after his death. As it turned out, though, at least in the explanations for the editors that dealt with it, that it was mostly all there. But in terms of how it's ordered, they were a little bit more meticulous about that than he had been with his second book. Some things, you know, may or may not have been in order when they look at the letters that he wrote home compared to what he was actually writing in his journal, you know, sometimes. But but complete, at least. And they do say that he has, it sounds as if he's a little less self-indulgent on his last leg. But then the guy comes out and, you know, he enters the Irish Guard and ends up in Crete because he's fluent in German and during World War II, and there he is responsible for German prisoners and a lot of other things, and he just leads an amazing life. And there was just a biography written of him last year too that I've ordered for the library. And right now I can't call the name because I've only seen it once. It was mentioned when I was looking at that review too, but I'm looking forward to that because he died in 2011 at 96 years old.
Wow!
He would really have a full life, you know. And well, he didn't write these things till he was in his 60s, you know, which also gave me kind of a kind of an affinity, you know, with him, you know, because he was looking back on before he was even 20 years old, starting out these things and assessing what he was, you know, about, and said, I'm in my 60s now. I'll write about that, you know. Published it, and it was, you know, everybody thought it was real. 77, I guess, is when this one came out. The first one came out in 1977. And the other one, I think, in 81 or 83, maybe, something like that.
And I feel like I have a book on my to-read list about the Caribbean by him. So has he written beyond these things?
Well, he did. But I know one has to do with Greece, and because he ended up living there. He loved Greece, and he ended up buying a place there. It mentions it in the other one, the books that he written since then. Now in the review that I read for this last one. But
I think
there's maybe five. Probably so. I certainly wouldn't doubt.
It's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah, he's pretty... his ability to recall, because you get the sense that's what he's doing, that he's not taking it from notes. He describes, you know, the action of birds and on a certain day, on a certain morning, and, you know, what the river looked like and all the rest of it, you know, so... If I could, I'll read you a part here.
Sure.
Unless you want me to wait. Okay. He's describing the Danube at this point, I forget exactly how far he is from. He's a good ways from getting to Estragon to where he actually will cross it. Mast shadows tilting down from the Sierras filled the bottom of the canyon. Here the Danube followed a winding corridor which expanded without warning to giant circular ballrooms and closed again just as abruptly, and for leagues on end this widening and shrinking ravine was empty of all but a cottage and a barn or two and a scattering of castles and lonely towers and hermitages, all crumbling to fragments. They broke through the forest mass, disintegrating on vertiginous spikes of rock high overhead. As I climbed the hill path, the ruins fell level and then dropped below, and the mountains opposite changed from a wall of branches into a maze of moraines and cliffs and buttresses with a ripple of meadows and solitary hamlets along their crests, all of them invisible till now and basking in the sunlight which was denied the lower world. Increasing height laid bare new reaches of the river like an ever-lengthening chain of lakes, and for those rare stretches where the valley ran east and west, the sunrise and the sunset lay reflected and still, and an illusion lifted each lake a step higher than its predecessor, until they formed gleaming staircases climbing in either direction, and at last the intervening headlands lost touch with the other shore, and the watery stairs, now far below, cohered in a single liquid serpent. At first, only a saw or an axe or the bang of a gun broke the silence of these forests. Soon other sounds would impinge, snow sliding from a branch, a loose rock starting a small avalanche, an occasional barge sending its siren ricocheting from cliff to cliff. Hidden streams, hardly noticed at first, were seldom out of earshot, but the waterfalls, though they were visible for miles, seemed inaudible until I was on them. I could see them cataracting from ledge to ledge, dividing and joining again, vanishing under the trees and dropping in long parabolas to the river, and all in silence, with seemingly as little motion as white horsetails swaying in the faintest of breezes. Then my path would round a spur of rock, and a murmur which had been growing slowly was all at once loud as thunder. From a ledge stalactitic, with icicles, tons of pale liquid jadeite crashed among the rocks, and the spray of its impact loaded the branches with fans of frozen drops. A trough of boulders and a tunnel of ice and a frozen bracken rushed it to the cliff's edge, and there, in a cloud of mist, flung it clear off the clustering stalactites in the treetops and sent it booming into the abyss and out of sight. Then the ensuing furlongs would hush the roar and slow the headlong pace to the ruffle of a faraway horsetail again. Taking you down the river, you know.
Seriously.
Yeah.
It's the kind of postcard you'd like to get from someone.
Yeah, isn't it though?
Putting you in a place that you can't be.
And you always feel the, you know, the chill of the icicles and, you know, of being above the river and next to it and, you know, how it might be flowing, you know, grudgingly. And then, you know, these barges he talks about making their way upstream occur fairly often with the tugboat that kind of, you know, urges them along. And he gets about 6 or 7 miles of a ride on one of these barges at one point with some guys he ends up drinking with in a tavern. It turns out when he goes to the barge to see if he can get a lift, the guys he was drinking with the night before work on the barge. So they set him up and put him out wherever he wants to. So, yeah, it's a remarkable trip. He kind of takes you in a sweeping sort of cultural journey. It's never without several facets at any one time. He doesn't dwell too long on one aspect of a region or a people or scenery or whatever. He allows you to sort of move along with it. He can get a little locked up in some of the history, but it all blends in together with where he is, and so it makes it that much more interesting.
Did it feel like the history was part of what was thrown in after, or did the history come from what he was writing at the time, do you think?
I think a lot of it was there at the time. He admits as it turned out, he went back and visited several of the places later on. And so it put him in mind more, I guess, of how it was then. And I'm sure that they became conflated, maybe his experience later on with what his earlier experience was. But he admits that he learned more later about some of the things that he does mention.
Sure.
But it flows so naturally when he's talking about it. He, whether it has to do with who built a particular cathedral and who was coronated here and why they were decapitated later and all that, and who was responsible for it and what happened to them later, and they were of this family. And it's really interesting to speak about the connections with, of course, all the European families, including England, the Snow Queen, Queen Elizabeth, James's granddaughter, I guess. So she was, she just kind of got stranded out there in Poland for a while, you know, in Bohemia, rather. She was queen of Bohemia, you know, for a while, and, you know, it's just crazy. But very, very, very interesting. I'm so looking forward to reading the Broken Road,
too. Oh, yeah. So it's officially out. It's just...
Yes. Yeah. And the thing about it is, in the book, or in the review, it indicated that it was actually published in 2013, but the review just came out, the first one I've seen of it.
Yeah.
This was in the New York Review of Books, but I knew that it was going to be published, but had never seen anything else, you know, about it. But so maybe it was just a delayed thing, but when I was checking around, I couldn't find out anybody else that had it, but it did show up so that we could order it, you know, so I made sure we did that.
Well, they sound amazing. I'm going to have to add them to my very long
good
list.
Good. Yeah, there's so many parts I know that you'd really get a kick out of. Yeah.
Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you, Jenny. Thank you. This has been so much fun. Love to talk about reading.
Me too. Today I have with me Libby Young. Libby is a librarian at Furman, where I work. Welcome, Libby.
Thanks. So you want me to tell you what kind of books I like to read?
Yes, please.
Well, I really like fiction, and I almost always find myself drawn to that. And I like to read the classics, and I like really good one-off books. I'm not much of a series reader. Hmm. I like something that's kind of unique, and I think sometimes it falls into a little bit of chick lit. But I definitely go off on all kinds of tangents, and I might have a time when I'm really into some kind of a historical fiction, or then I might go into the black women writers for a while. And I used to read a lot of YA novels. I don't read as many now, but kind of all over the map.
So how do you get your ideas of what you want to read?
Well, since I work in a library, it's really hard to not just want to pick up every book I see. And I've been in a book club for about maybe 5 or 6 years, and we read one book a month. So a lot of my ideas come from there, because I don't have that much time to read, so I will always usually read my book club books first. And the good thing about that is it causes me to read books that I might not necessarily choose on my own, and 95% of the time that ends up being a good thing. If I really don't like it, I won't read it, and because I don't have enough time to waste on something I hate. But sometimes I just need a little nudge, and I'll even read nonfiction, and I'll be really glad afterwards that I've read it. So I like to go to bookstores and look at staff picks. That's always a good way of finding something. I like to do that with Malaprops in Asheville. Mm-hmm. Their staff picks are awesome.
They're always good.
Yeah. So it's really more of a chance. I mean, it's more like, how do I choose what not to read?
Right. So your book club is like a neighborhood book club? Is that what I'm
Yes,
saying?
It's the Earl Street Book Club. And most of us are from Earl Street or have lived on Earl Street at some point. But we let a few other people in.
I've never heard of one from your street before I moved to the South. But I understand that it's kind of a common thing.
I don't know about any others. But it's been a great thing. We have a very close neighborhood. And a lot of people have young children, and that's the basis of their friendships. And so since my kids are older, this is a really nice way for me to connect with my neighbors. And we have a wide range of ages, but it is mostly female.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Neat. So what has been the best book that you've read with that book club? Because you remember one?
Oh, my goodness. Oh, that's hard.
They've all been good?
There have been so many good books. Mm. We really liked Room.
Mm-hmm.
And A Strange Balance was one that I had suggested that I love. Everybody in my book club just wanted to kill me because it was the most depressing book ever and so long. And you put so much effort into it, and then you're just left devastated. But I love that book. City of Lights, the book. And we read... what is something in the White City? Devil in the White City. Last year. I would never have picked that up on my own, but I ended up liking it a lot.
It's one of those nonfiction examples.
Yeah.
So you've brought a book to talk about today.
And this is not from book club, but I'm going to suggest it in the fall for my book club, because we usually have one meeting where we all shout out books, and we try to narrow it down to 12.
Fun.
And so I'm going to suggest The Gollum and the Genie by Helene Wecker next time we choose our books, which is usually August or September. And I found this here at the Furman Library, and that's how I came upon it, but also it was recommended to me by Robin, our co-worker, who's...
She's really good at books.
Yeah, she's a voracious reader, and a lot of times our taste intersects. Not always, but a lot of times, so...
What is it about?
Well, a golem is a mythological creature in Jewish culture, and it's a creature that's created usually out of clay, and then it becomes animated. And then the genie, and I don't know if I'm pronouncing that correctly, it's J-I-N-N-I, but I call him a genie.
Yeah, because it comes out of the...
Yeah.
Same kind of spiggy.
So that's a mythological creature in, I guess, Arab or Middle Eastern kind of mythology. Mm-hmm. And it's a creature who is kind of like a free spirit, roams the desert. So this book is just... She's such a great writer, and she uses them as a vehicle for telling the story. It's not so much that it's about magical things as she uses them as a setup to kind of explore creating an identity. The Gollum is a woman who was created to be somebody's wife. And then very early in the book, and I'm not giving anything away by this, the man for whom she's created dies. So she's a Gollum left without a master, and Gollums are created to serve a master. She ends up in, I guess, turn of the century New York City, maybe the late 1800s?
It seems around
there. Yeah. So she finds herself on her own in this city, and she has to forge an identity. And I guess that's kind of one of the ploys of the book, is that this golem is sort of a tabula rasa, and she has to form an identity, and how is she going to do it? And then the genie is just like in mythology, somebody who's been stuck in a bottle or an oil can, I think it is. He's been put in there by an evil magician, and he makes his way to New York City in the oil can, and he's freed unknowingly by somebody, and he's also in a foreign place. It's a lot about being out of place in this metropolitan area. And they're very different in their approaches to being in New York at this historical moment, but they end up having a kind of a troubled friendship with each other, and that's what the rest of the book is based on. But I would say that New York City is also a third character in the book, and that's one of the things I liked about it. I thought she did a great job with evoking a setting and reading about that time in New York where things were very ethnic. He was in a Syrian enclave in the city. She was in a Jewish kind of ghetto part of the city. And the people were working class people. And it was hot and it was crowded. And they walked, both of them, just by coincidence, walked and walked and walked to kind of get away from the crowds that didn't understand them, because they were kind of homesick. And so during that walking, you kind of see Central Park and other parts of the city at that turn of the century time with some carriages, but it's also kind of smoky and smoggy. And I just thought that was very evocative.
Yeah, very smart writing. I should say, we read this in my book club this past year, and I hadn't read it yet before that time, so... It was interesting how everyone really liked it. And it was mostly for the historical part.
Okay.
I mean, they liked the character, thought the story was interesting, but mm-hmm. it didn't really necessarily matter that they were fantastical creatures. They could have just been a man and a woman, and I think they would have felt the exact same way.
I think so, too. It just added a little bit of interest to the predicament that they were in. But it wasn't at all like a science fiction or mm-hmm. fantasy kind of novel. That that was just a device, I think,
it
she
felt
used.
Very real, actually.
It did. It was very grounded in history. And it was also interesting, the interaction between the Jewish community and the Syrian community. Mm-hmm. That was kind of a neat twist on things. The languages that everybody was speaking and that kind of thing, too.
Yeah, and I liked that the golem was a baker.
It was interesting because she didn't really like to eat that much.
No,
so
she didn't need to.
She didn't need to eat, right, to survive. And so in that sense, I couldn't relate to her. But she worked in a bakery, and it talked a lot about the food and the kind of breads that they were creating. So that was neat. Yeah, I agree.
I think the thing I remember the most is her laying in bed trying to remember to breathe because she didn't need to breathe.
Yeah.
But her husband or whoever, I can't remember, she was laying next to the man. I don't think it's her husband, I guess. It's
yeah,
been
it was.
A while.
Yeah,
okay.
I think so.
And he would get worried if he woke up and she wasn't breathing.
Because yeah.
he never really caught on. You kind of wonder how.
I know. That was a little far-fetched. And then she liked to stay up all night because she didn't need sleep. And so sometimes she would have to turn out her light just so people would not be suspicious of her.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's kind of a strange way to live.
But it has a very climactic ending, and mm-hmm. so it kept you really turning the page. It was kind of an exciting book to see how things were going to work out, too.
Oh, yeah.
But I reread the last chapter when I knew we were going to talk about this, and I think it may have actually left itself open for a sequel.
Ooh,
possibly. I don't know. But I was just amazed that Helene Wecker was a first-time writer.
I know. It was very intricate for first-time writing.
I thought so, too.
And I'd never heard of her before. I'd never mm-hmm. heard of this novel before. It just kind of seemed to appear, and then everyone was talking about
yeah.
it. I saw it on... I always look at those end-of-year lists. Mm-hmm. It was on so many of those.
I don't... Yeah, I can imagine. I don't know how she got it promoted and all that kind of stuff, but it is a kind of word-of-mouth book.
Oh,
I
yeah.
told so many people about it.
I can think of at least 5 people in the library that have read it too, because everyone keeps spreading it around.
Yeah.
A lot of the friends I have, like in Goodreads, said that the audio is really good too, but I haven't tried it.
Oh, I bet that would be neat because of the accents and mm-hmm. stuff too.
Yeah. So have you read any other good New York books?
Huh.
I was thinking of one. I can't remember the title. I'll look it up when I post this. But it was a nonfiction book about living in tenements around the same era. And I had read that first, so I was picturing all of those people that were mentioned in that book, because it was written through like photographs and like it had some real representative people. I think they kind of made up some of it just
uh-huh.
to kind of make a story out of
yeah.
it. But it fit into the same world.
Well, one of my favorite books, and it's set a little bit later, is A Tree Grows in Brooklyn.
Oh.
And both of my daughters love it and have read it multiple times. I've read it a couple of times. And, yeah, I like stuff about New York. I was born in New York, and I was there 2 weeks ago, and I found the hospital where I had been born.
Wow.
It's not a hospital anymore. It was called the French Hospital. But it's now called the French Apartments. But over the doors are the medical, like an apothecary thing is chiseled in above the door. And it has a phrase in French about doing good to the sick. So that was kind of exciting. And I was thinking about her walking through New York. And I was walking.
So this had really stuck with you.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for coming on.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Our last guest for this episode is Mike Winiski. Mike works in the same building as me, but is not a librarian. Can you tell us a little bit about what you do?
Yeah, I work in the Center for Teaching and Learning, and that involves working with faculty to design their courses or implement a particular assignment. I also teach. I teach geographic information systems, mapping, and spatial analysis, and I teach a first-year seminar about Mars.
Wonderful. And you've actually been on one other podcast that I'm on.
I have, yeah.
The SFF Audio podcast, and we talked about The Martian by Andy Weir, I think is how you say his name. That was great, too.
That was a lot of fun. Yeah. I had a great time.
So what kind of books do you like to read?
I'm kind of a nonfiction guy. I'll read some fiction, but I always seem to swing back when it seems like less work and more fun. So I'm a big fan of Edward Abbey, you know, Desert Solitaire, and the Monkey Wrench Gang. And for some reason, I seem to always circle back to polar exploration. So Endurance by Alfred Lansing, the story of Ernst Shackleton's mishap in the Antarctic, I really liked. And I just finished another one, Mawson's Will, that was outstanding. So I don't know why. I feel like with nonfiction, I feel like I'm kind of killing two birds with one stone. I'm learning something new. And I'm not saying you can't learn something from fiction, but for some reason, I just I like circling back to nonfiction.
I didn't realize Desert Solitaire was nonfiction. I guess all
well,
the time.
Well, knowing Edward Abbey, you know, there could be some stuff thrown in. It's it's just a great book about his couple of summers in Arches National Park and just his adventures there and the people he knew and not canoeing, but rafting down the old Glen Canyon before it was flooded. So just his description, I usually don't like all this description of setting and and place, but for some reason, the way he does it just, I don't know, it makes the place come alive.
That's great. So have you been reading anything interesting lately?
I read, I don't even know what to think about this book, and when I taught the Mars course, I started getting into science fiction, which I had never really been that into. And so I had revisited some things I read as a kid and then started, you know, reconnecting with it. And so the Andy Weir book that we talked about, The Martian, I enjoyed. And because of that, I just picked up another one called Red Rising by Pierce Brown. I don't know if anybody, if you've read that or anybody's talking about that. And it's a book I don't know what I think. It's a book that takes place on Mars, which is sort of my sci-fi anchor. And there is the protagonist is an underground miner and lives in this underground mining community in Mars. And it turns out there's this whole other world up above Mars that they didn't know about. And they're low on the social order. And I won't give it away. But it reminded me, and I haven't read The Hunger Games, but it's very much, and almost at times it felt a little bit too much like The Hunger Games. I've seen the movies with my daughters, but I haven't read it. It seems to take a lot, but it starts to bridge into, I'm sort of this hard sci-fi person, although I really like Philip K. Dick, and I can be persuaded to enter the realm, but this also almost enters a fantasy realm where I felt like it took me to a place where I wasn't sure I liked that I could make the leap that the author was asking me to make.
So for when you read science fiction, it needs to really be grounded in science. Is that what the difference is, you think?
Yeah, it really does. Unless I'm really into, but then I think about the obvious counter to that is Philip K. Dick. I love his stuff, but there's something about his tone that you're making an agreement right up front that this is going to be a little bit silly.
Yeah, a little absurd.
Yeah, and you know, just come along this ride with me. And just because of the way that he sets the stage, I'm willing to play. Whereas this one, you know, it starts out in a mine and under Mars. That all seems like it's possible. And but then it starts to sort of break the contract. I don't want to make it sound like I'm this rigid reader, but it just seems to break the contract a little bit where things happen that it makes it a little hard to connect the dots that's possible.
You know? Yeah. And then it takes you out of it.
It does. Yeah.
Yeah. That bothers me when I'm buying into something and then bam, something removes me. It could be like a word that's misused or even something small like that sometimes.
And they're writing so many words, they're bound to make a mistake somewhere in there, but yeah.
Like, come on, that's not believable. I know you're talking about Mars, but
yeah.
Is there anything else about Mars that you've read that has done a better job, I guess, in the science area?
I think this is another one where it's an example of I'm okay with it. The Martian Chronicles, I really I really enjoyed rereading those, getting ready to teach the class. And it seems, has the same kind of feel as a Philip K. Dick book. You know, we're going to, if this is going to be a little nonsensical, you know, come along. And, but again, the tone sort of sets the stage, and it seemed like I was willing to play. And I'm not, but I think Red Rising was a great, it was a fun read. I just, there were points in the book where I was like, I really don't like this. And then I was like, no, I really like this. This last chapter worked out pretty well. It just, I don't know if other readers will have the same experience.
Now, if I remember that book correctly, is it the first book in a series?
It is. Something? I don't think the second book has come. I think the second book is due in 2015.
So it's really recent.
It is. It's part of a planned trilogy, I think.
That should be interesting. Did you get the sense that it will all take place on Mars? Unless that gives something.
Well, no. I mean, they've left the possibility open that they were already talking about travel between planets and moons and all that kind of stuff. So I don't think it'll just necessarily be limited.
Sounds good.
I'm anxious for you to read it because I want to hear what, I want to hear what you have to say about it.
The more you talk about it, the more I remember us talking about it on the SFF audio podcast, I think, because it just came out in audio. Like the cover in particular, I'm bringing it back in my head. It was really simple. Like a, like
Red
a wing
Wings.
Or something.
Yeah, that's it. That's the book.
Yeah, seemed familiar.
Yeah, I'm trying to think what else. Here's I'm just looking at my Goodreads list here, but one book that I recently read that I really enjoyed was called The Devil and Sherlock Holmes by David Graham, who I think writes for the either New York Times or The New Yorker. And it, I mean, I think the title is a little bit misleading. It's the first story is about, I'm forgetting his name, Oliver, the guy that wrote Sherlock Holmes,
Doyle.
Arthur, thank you. I was going to say Oliver Wendell Holmes. I knew that wasn't right. Arthur Conan Doyle. And it was just about his life and some of the mysteries in his life and the way his estate was being handled, and about somebody who had been involved in studying his life who had been murdered. And then it goes into these other real stories. And it, the guy's a great writer. He follows some of the things that are going on, gang-related in prisons, to unsolved murder mysteries, to... It was a really good book, but they're nonfiction again. So.
Yeah, well, how'd you come across that one? Do you remember?
I think it was a Goodreads recommendation, or maybe it showed up in Amazon when I was searching for some other books.
Yeah, well, let's talk about that a little. How do you find books to read most of the time?
I look at your list.
No.
I look at Brian
Alex. It can't just be me.
I look at your list. I get the weekly updates from Goodreads, so I look at your lists. I can't keep up with you, but, I'd look at what you're reading and what's on your wish list. I look at Brian Alexander's. There's some stuff about the, you know, the early Russian history that I've marked as maybe potentially to read, but I don't know how high it'll move up the list.
Yeah, and he reads a lot of history, just in general.
Yeah. And I think he's more into fantasy than I'm into, but he's also, I really like the way, after having been on the podcast, the way he thinks about books and how much he knows about history and how that comes into play with the way he approaches books.
We were talking about possibly in the future having a conversation just about how we talk about books, how we think about books, because it would be really interesting. He comes from a more academic, trained side, I think. So, in talking about that.
And I'm not. That's why I'm scared to death to be on your podcast. I'm not trained to talk about books. I enjoy them.
But you love books. That's the whole point.
I do. And I've been reading, we're in this group that was reading the Wired for Story book. And I picked that up again this week and read a couple more chapters just because I'm really curious about what makes a good story. And I'm kind of curious to hear about what happened in your class as far as, you know, what elements of story did the students seem to hone in on.
Yeah, the funny thing is I had readings set aside for them to read, like from that book and from the storytelling Animal and from a few other books. And instead of having them read those, we watched people tell stories who have won storytelling competitions, and we made our own list. And then we compared the list with what the official lists say.
Wow, that's awesome.
And they were the same.
They were.
They didn't miss anything. No.
So they don't need the book anyway, right?
I guess not. maybe it's really intuitive. I mean, you can tell what people are doing well, and you know what when something's good, you feel it.
There's that's hard to articulate, though. That's why I get so nervous about it. It's hard to articulate why that book connected so much.
I have to really sit and think about it sometimes. Like, I have this book that I finished last week, A Girl on the Road by Monica Burns, and I can't stop thinking about it, and I'm not sure I could tell you why. I've tweeted with the author about it. I've tweeted with other people who've read it. I've reviewed it. I've posted about it. And I'm just like, why can't I get that book out of my head? I think sometimes they just kind of, I don't know what it connected with. It's near future. It was really interesting technology. I stayed up really late one night reading about metallic hydrogen because it's used in the book and I didn't know what it was. And it actually only exists in theory. I don't know. It's just, I guess it maybe it captured something in my head. Like, I was starting to think about it and the possibilities, and my imagination kind of expanded a little bit. I think I look for that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And when I'm reading.
So, I mean, so what did you rate this book?
I gave it 5 stars just because of that.
Really?
Because I just couldn't stop. Like, at first I was like, well, this is like a 4-star book. I mean, it was really good. It's her first novel. And, you know, I like the combination of potentially practical science that doesn't exist yet, but used in a way. And it's set in Africa, and things are hardly ever set in Africa. And there's 2 different times going on at the same time, 2 characters' stories that go back and forth. So there's just a lot to like about it.
From the near future and...
Yeah, they're both near future. One is like 30 years in the future, and one is 60.
Huh.
But the 2 characters are related in some ways. So you don't really figure out how until the end. And there's some creatures that I'm not sure if they exist. Some characters, I'm not sure if they're real. I don't know.
But sounds like I'd like it.
Yeah. There's enough going on that seems grounded where it's not completely unbelievable. So then the elements that aren't, it's almost like you're more willing to entertain them, I guess.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think if I have a really good reading experience, whether it's because I've had a good discussion about a book, or I can't stop thinking about it, I'll rate it higher. And sometimes I don't like rating books at all. I kind of force myself to do it, but I give so many books 3 stars. Because to me, 3 means, decent.
Yeah.
Not
good
awful.
Try, yeah.
Maybe someone else's thing, you know. But 3 out of 5 doesn't seem very high.
No. Yeah, is it a grading scale?
Right.
Yeah.
Like, I just gave that person a C.
Yeah. Well, thanks for
thank you for coming on. Yeah. We could talk for hours about books.
I feel, I don't know, I feel in the last couple of years kind of reinvigorated with my relationship with reading.
Yeah.
I mean, I really do. So
it helps. It helps when you connect with people that are reading. Does it?
It does. It does. I would still like to read a book together with a group of people at some time, which I don't think I've ever done.
Hi, this is Jenny one last time. I would just like to thank Steve and Mike and Libby for joining me on episode 8 of the Reading Envy podcast. See you next time. Thank you for listening to the Reading Envy podcast. You can find us at readingenvy.com.